Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from geopolitics.com. We're now 4 months into 2025, second quarter, and there's so much going on in the world. We thought it would be a good idea to cover as many topics as possible just to kind of get through what's been going on in the first quarter of this year. We asked you guys on our social media platforms to send in your questions so me and Adnan can then discuss them. And we have Adnan here, our Geopolitics founder. How are you keeping, Adnan? I think it's been a while since we last met.
It has. I'm doing well, Yusuf. It has been a while. I think probably over a month or so. But yeah, it's good to be back.
Yeah, I think you caught that link. I think you caught the bug that everyone's been catching.
I did, unfortunately. Europe this time of the year, it's just come to the end of flu season. So I was out for about a week or so. But yeah, raring to go now.
So we've got a lot to get through because of that. So I want to remind everyone that you'll find us on all major social media platforms where you can subscribe and you'll never miss a thing. So Adnan, we're coming up to the first 100 days Donald Trump's been in power. Donald Trump's been in office and he's changing everything. It's a key metric for measuring how well a president's doing the first 100 days. How are things going so far for Donald Trump?
So, yes, so Trump's had quite a busy first 100 days. I'm not a big fan of this 100-day metric. It's become a common measurement now in politics, when governments come in. You know, people even have a first 100-day policy. Really, very little happened in 100 days because the reality of ruling is key strategic things take time. Even they take time to come up with policy. But for some reason, everybody likes 100 days, 3 months and a bit. There's very little that can be done. In the case of Trump, obviously, as far as Trump was concerned, the first term, he left business unfinished. So for him, the second term was going to be really to complete the project he started. So what we've seen in the first 100 days or so, well, Ukraine's been dropped like a rock. Russia is now the ally. Russia is now the partner America wants to work with. We see just this week, tariffs have been raised. In fact, global tariffs have been raised. This is quite unprecedented in history. America continues to talk about acquiring or conquering or unifying with Greenland. The vice president was just in Greenland with his wife. And he keeps talking about how Denmark has really let Greenland down. And America really isn't letting this one go. We've seen the continuation of the support for Israel. I'm sure we're going to discuss this further, but nothing's really changed on that side. In fact, if anything, the support from America or the silence to what's taking place in Gaza and the region, that's really continued as normal. The defense budget is going up despite Trump talking about reducing America's global presence and not getting involved in wars. Trump, in his first 100 days, gave a new contract to, out of all companies, Boeing, to manufacture and come up with the sixth generation jet, the next jet after the fifth generation jets America is using currently. And I think probably in summary, you know, Trump had two goals, really, internal and external. Internally, Trump has got all his MAGA, Make America Great Again, supporters in key positions. He's got Kennedy as the head of the medical area. He's got Elon Musk. He's got former WWF leader Linda McMahon as the education secretary. So you find internally, Trump has really battened down now. He's realized in his first term, he depended on a lot of people who weren't necessarily supportive of his views. This time he has. Externally, the main thing we're really getting is the US is no longer going to support the global rules-based order. It's no longer going to support global security. People who relied on the global rules-based order, people who relied on global security, they now need to fund it themselves. And that's why you keep hearing from America, no more freeloading. So yeah, it's been quite a busy first 100 days, but as I mentioned, 100 days out of a full four-year term isn't really a long time. And already Trump has done a U-turn on some areas. So we'll have to wait and see. But yes, it's typical Trump fashion, very loud, very aggressive. Unfortunately, I'm sure everyone saw what happened to Zelensky. That's very Trump-esque how he does it. But yeah, let's see how things go.
Yeah, so you mentioned about the sweeping tariffs that Trump put on the rest of the world. What was funny is I heard Russia didn't actually have any tariffs put on any of their exports. What impact will the tariffs have globally, and what is Trump actually trying to achieve with them?
Yeah, so Trump is in love with tariffs. He applied tariffs as a tool in his first term as well. And obviously nothing like this is completely sweeping. I mean, it's quite unprecedented in economic history to really do this. And Trump's strategy isn't actually clear. Even the end goal isn't clear. What you hear is America's being raped, America's being abused, and enough is enough, we're hitting back. So he sort of like is blaming other countries for abusing their trade relationship with America. And what he means by that is America seems to have a trade deficit with most countries. That is, America seems to import from more countries than it actually exports. So how this is the problem of other countries when you just don't sell enough to them really leaves a lot to be desired. But nevertheless, that's a strategy Trump's gone with. This strategy is popular with his support base because they believe Trump is finally doing something about the economic reality in America. They believe America's been gutted, American manufacturing's gone abroad, and this is going to bring it back. Unfortunately, it's actually not going to bring it back, because if you want to expand your manufacturing, you need to invest in it. You need to build factories. You need to build the infrastructure. That's not what Trump is doing. What Trump is doing is he's charging a tax on imports, which will bring in more revenues to the government. But it actually doesn't deal with the situation in the country, doesn't deal with the loss of industry or anything like that. So I think a lot of stuff is getting mixed up with how loud Trump is and the threats Trump's making. The reality here is many companies in America went abroad because it was cheaper. It was cheaper to make things in Vietnam, in China, in India. To manufacture things in America is very expensive. You obviously have labor laws. Nevertheless, for Trump supporters, he's finally doing something about it. So even the rate of tariffs varies depending on each country. Interestingly, America, income tax is the tax that brings in the most revenue for the government currently. But income tax was only introduced in 1913 in America. Up until that point, tariffs were the number one source of revenue for the government. Now, if Trump wanted to get rid of income tax and just use tariffs only, he'd have to charge 60-70% tariffs on the world. If he did that, the world would just go somewhere else to trade. They wouldn't even trade with America. So as far as Trump's concerned, the trade deficit is what he's trying to deal with. And the trade deficit isn't America's fault. It's the fault of other countries who don't buy from America enough but sell more to America. This is going to cause inflation as well. If you are charging more on people who import, the manufacturers in America, the people buying in raw materials, they will have to pass on this extra cost now to the consumer, which sort of goes against what Trump's trying to do. And you find with this tariff strategy, there's a lot of economic fundamentals that Trump every day is contradicting. So we'll have to wait and see, but it's definitely unprecedented.
Isn't the idea with tariffs that, the price of imports increase, but that would actually almost motivate people to buy US goods, and it should hopefully create an opening for US companies to start their own manufacturing companies of these goods. So instead of shipping it in from abroad, they actually start doing it locally. Isn't that the idea? Shouldn't that work?
So what any normal or sane person would do would be to invite the CEOs of the top 100 US companies, sit them down and say, look, you guys need to bring manufacturing home. You need to recruit and employ Americans. And we need to make America great again. And you would likely offer sweeteners, tax breaks, free land in order for this to happen. What Trump has done, he's blamed other countries. He's saying, you're the reason why we have a trade deficit. He hasn't targeted America. American companies in the 90s left America and went to China because it was cheaper. So surely the American companies are the problem here. Surely you should be dealing with them. He's not. What he's doing is he's targeting foreign countries. And then keep in mind, when you import into any country, it's the importer who pays the tariff, not the exporter. So when America imports from China, whoever imports those goods sitting in America, they will pay the tariff.
Yep.
So what's happened is overnight, the taxes companies pay are going up. These taxes are revenues for the government. And apparently the government's plan is, or Trump's plan is to use these to give tax breaks to the wealthiest and things like that. So a lot of this, what Trump is doing, it actually goes against economic fundamentals. I remember very clearly when Putin took over in the 1990s, he got all the oligarchs in a room, and you can still find the video online, and he told them that, look, enough's enough. You raped the country. From now on, you make money by investing and through your profits. You're not going to get involved in politics. Some of them tried to get involved in politics and they ended up in prison, like Khodorkovsky. But Putin realized the problem here isn't other countries aren't buying enough. The problem is you companies aren't operating like normal companies. So the fact that Trump's targeted other countries and blamed them when their own companies aren't actually doing it. So surely you'd think the simple thing would be to sit your companies down and tell them, here's some tax breaks. Here's a grand plan for the country. We're going to make America great again. What he's done is I'm putting tariffs on, which probably what this means is you put tariffs on and these countries then now come and make deals with you to reduce these tariffs. And this is how Trump works. It's a very convoluted way of working, but also Trump has really hurt America's credibility. This was the free market country. This was the country that advocated free markets and free trade around the world. Now they're putting up the most barriers than any other country.
So, yeah, one thing that Trump, he's been talking about tariffs a lot, but one thing he hasn't spoken about once is America's growing debt. It's absolutely huge. And it's getting to be quite a problem. Is it because he thinks that the US can just print more dollars and the world will just keep using it because the world relies on dollars?
So interestingly, Trump has not said anything about America's ballooning debt. I think the debt is about $34 trillion. This is more than the US economy. And the reason why he's not talking about it is because if he wants to do tax breaks, how are you going to fund it? If you want to cut the deficit, how are you going to fund it? And his plan is he's not going to increase taxes because that's not very popular. What he plans to do is what every previous president's done, is he's just going to take on more and more debt. And that's why he doesn't actually talk about it. And yes, a chunk of American debt is then bought by other countries. And because the dollar is a reserve currency, he can do that. However, America has a problem, and it has a problem that all empires have. And that is America isn't just funding its own budget. It has to fund a global military. It has to fund a global system. It has to fund the empire. And the funding of this empire is now out of control. And that's why America's debt is out of control. We do need to keep in mind that 30% of US debt, so 30% of that $34 trillion debt is actually held, is only held by foreign entities. The majority of the debt is actually held internally. So you always hear that China owns a lot of this debt. Yes, China owns the highest amount of this 30%. The other 70% is actually held by American institutions, American departments, things like that. But what this all shows you is America is living on debt. The empire is living on debt. And these things always end really, really badly.
This idea that they're living on debt, I mean, I think their debt surpassed their GDP. It wasn't a recent thing. It was a good few years ago. Hasn't the world realized that America is running on fumes and that they should actually abandon the dollar? I know there's been attempts, for example, the euro and the BRICS nations. Are we getting any traction on that front?
So the loudest on this issue has really been countries like China, countries like Russia. But what you find is other countries haven't really followed. And that's because you know, America has a lot of things in place which place it in a very advantageous position. The fact that its currency is the reserve currency, so that's why people prefer to have debt in the dollar. However, what America's done under Trump has really brought to light what they think about the world. So the Signalgate controversy has shown what they really think about Europe. They believe Europe are freeloaders. And I think now it's dawning on people that they actually need to begin decoupling from America. America is a problem. America is potentially the long-term enemy. America doesn't have at heart the well-being of the Europeans and its allies. And I think now countries will really start looking at already, I mean, gold prices are going up. Central banks around the world have been buying up gold, which uses an indicator that you want to make some strategic changes. So you're right, I think. I think the Europeans never believed. I mean, if you're a European leader, how do you tell your people we need to still maintain a good relationship with America when America is very open what they think about you? They believe you'd pay for your freeloader. You know, we've had enough of you. And you heard the defense secretary, the national security advisor. These are key American personnel, what they really think about Europe. So, yeah, absolutely. I think we're there now. I think usually these calls were from China, Venezuela, Cuba, Russia. Now it's dawning on the Europeans that, you know, America is actually a problem now.
So on this point, do you think Trump is really trying to alter the US global policy? Is it just rhetoric? Sometimes I think with the way that the Europeans, European leaders are acting, it's almost that they're thinking, okay, we just need to get through these next 4 years and hopefully Trump won't be re-elected. Or is it this is the new direction that America is taking?
So this is actually quite an important question in the context we're in. And really what it comes down to is what is US strategic policy? And does that change and who determines it? US strategic policy, this is the long-term direction of America. This is not determined by the government. This is not determined even by the president. This is actually determined by the US elites who are unelected and they are not affected by the election cycle. So their view of America's direction is America is an empire and we have to maintain that empire. So what does that mean? It means that America has to ensure dominance of Eurasia. America has to ensure it controls directly or indirectly the energy of the Middle East because of how much it is in terms of volume. And that America needs to contain these European powers who potentially can become a problem. Now, how this is done, this is a styles of news discussion. This is affected by the government and this is affected by the resources any given president has. So you find US established a global system to maintain American dominance. It established a global military presence. In many regions of the world, America establishes a balance of power in order to make sure no one nation can dominate or challenge America. Now, all of this, it has a cost. It has a cost on the American economy. It requires resources. And depending on the priorities, this can chop and change. So currently, the American elite, they want America or whoever the president is to confront China. China is a rising power and China is potentially going to challenge America's dominance of Eurasia, which is one of the strategic issues for America. These elites, they want Europe and NATO to pick up the burden of their own security. So during the Cold War, America had no problem providing security for its allies because it served its agenda. The Cold War is 30 years old. What America feels, why is it funding? Why is it? Because America has to fund an empire. Now funding the Europeans isn't really feasible. So this is a change in priorities. The US elites also feel that the global system they established after World War II, it no longer serves America like it did. In fact, other countries are benefiting from it more. China has probably benefited more from globalization than even America. In fact, American jobs, American industry was decimated and it's all gone to China. So Trump is doing exactly this. He's confronting China. He's putting tariffs on China. He's targeting Europe. And this is why the US elites supported him into power. He might be brash. He quite frankly doesn't have a clue what he's doing when it comes to long-term policy. But on the issue of where they want America to go in terms of direction, he's doing that. So Trump isn't actually changing American policy. What he's doing is getting it in line with where the US elites want it to go. And yes, there are some changes in styles and means. The global order that's been around for 70 odd years, that's been dropped, but it doesn't serve America anymore.
Okay, let's go into some of the questions that were sent in about specific areas in the world. So first of all, Ukraine. Ukraine, it's 3 years now. Who would have ever seen this? The US is now pro-Russia and anti-Ukraine. Peace talks have begun, and it seems that the US president has more affinity to Putin over Zelensky. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, so it's surprising how so much can change in just 3 years.
Bromance.
Sorry?
Bromance.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, it's looking like more of a bromance now. I mean, Zelensky's been dumped very publicly in the Oval Office, and Putin's now being embraced. In fact, the Ukraine war, according to Trump now, was the fault of Ukraine. It wasn't actually the fault of Russia.
And then Putin recently sent him a portrait of Trump that as a gift.
Yes, yes. I mean, he would have. I mean, not so long ago, he's committing a genocide. Putin's committing a massacre. You know, not anymore. Now they're talking. Now, in fact, they're not just talking. They're actually having strategic discussions on different parts of the world. I think we've said previously that the Ukrainians are the Kurds of Europe, and now it's confirmed. Now, everything America did for the last 3 years in terms of sanctions, in terms of supporting Ukraine, all of that's being reversed. But we've got to keep in mind that even before Trump came into power, there was many people in Congress that were questioning the support for Ukraine. They were questioning why we're still fighting Russia. What Trump has done now is he's come in and just implemented the direction policy was going anyway. So that's why, according to Trump, all his narrative now is in line with this direction now. So Ukraine is a problem. Why did we give so much money to Ukraine? He keeps saying America's giving $350 billion to Ukraine. That's not true. It's only actually been $120 billion. And just a week ago, the New York Times did a very in-depth piece on America's role in the Ukraine war. And what comes to light, according to the New York Times Post, is America was much more involved on the war on the ground than previously was known. America was providing intelligence. America was using satellites to pinpoint where Russian units were. And there was a lot of occasions where American officials fell out with Ukrainian soldiers because Ukrainian soldiers wanted to use this information to do more damage, and America didn't let them. And we've always said in our podcast that really, if America wanted, it could have put in a lot more resources, but that wasn't America's agenda. It was never its agenda. So what's becoming clear now is America really wants to get Russia on its side. America really wants to drop Ukraine. It looks like Ukraine is actually going to lose the 20% of territory. America is really talking up these ceasefire talks, but what we're hearing from Russia is the opposite. Russia's actually putting more conditions down. Russia's actually saying we're only going to agree to a ceasefire if we see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So Russia's not rolling over, which is actually really, really interesting. And this really comes down to something very simple. Why the sudden change? Well, the sudden change is because America wants to confront China, and the road to Beijing now goes through Kiev and Moscow. That is what Ukraine is all about. The Ukraine war, getting Russia involved, getting Russia bogged down, and then negotiating with Russia from a position of strength for America is really all about China. And America's not even hiding this now. So the talks that have happened between American officials and Russian officials, only a small part of the discussion has actually been about the war and the ceasefire. Most of the discussion has been about energy. It's been about technology. It's been about the Arctic and America and Russia doing projects together. So what this shows is America wants to get Russia on its side by organizing the world and making some strategic deals in order to weaken the relationship with China. And now we know the whole Ukraine war for America was always about China. It was always about getting Russia bogged down. So Russia agrees to America's terms. The Ukrainians are now learning this, unfortunately, the hard way.
I was just going to say, it sounds similar to what they did in the Cold War. But in reverse, they tried to pull China away from its relationship with Russia.
Yes, they call this a reverse Nixon. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, they were able to take advantage of the tension between China and Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s. And eventually they were able to win China over. And that completely undermined the Eastern Bloc. This whole idea that the Eastern Bloc is a unified communist camp was completely undermined. And interestingly, that opening is actually what led to China to develop and where it is today. I mean, who would have thought China would come to a point where it could challenge America? That wasn't the agenda at the time. But let's wait and see. Russia has quite a deep relationship with China, military, economic, energy, strategic as well. I don't think Russia will want to give up China. It knows it can't trust America, but when America comes knocking, Russia feels we're a power. That's why you've come to us. That's why you're talking to us. So we'll have to wait and see what comes off this. But it shows you that American policy, you know, everyone is an ally of America. You can be dropped when America has other interests. And that's what Ukraine is now learning the hard way.
Except if you're Israel, which goes to our next section. So the first phase of the ceasefire in Palestine has ended, and it's debatable whether there was even a ceasefire. Israel didn't actually follow the terms. Where do things currently stand in Gaza, in the West Bank and the broader region?
So we've just seen, well, the effective end or sabotage of the ceasefire. We now know that the only reason there was a ceasefire was because Donald Trump sent his mate, his real estate buddy, Steve Witkoff, to read Netanyahu the Riot Act. The ceasefire deal was proposed by Biden back in May, and Netanyahu dragged his feet all that time, because the ceasefire means you stop fighting, you put your arms down, and there's some exchange of prisoners, which is not what Israel wanted to do. Israel wants to take over the region. So America imposed this. But as you mentioned, during the ceasefire, Israel never ceased firing. It killed hundreds of people. And in fact, as soon as the ceasefire began in January, straight away Israeli officials started saying they're not going to go on to a second stage of the ceasefire. The ceasefire really is a multi-stage deal. It's not a one deal. The first part is you have a two-month ceasefire. And on the 15th day of the first stage, you begin talks about the second stage. So the first stage was about a ceasefire. It was about a hostage exchange and about Israel withdrawing from some areas of Gaza. The second stage was Israel completely withdraws and a durable long-term peace settlement is agreed. And then the third stage was really about post-war reconstruction. Israel never attended, or in fact, it was quite open that they don't want the second stage of the deal. What they want to do is restart the war. Now, what was interesting is Trump and Witkoff imposed the ceasefire on Netanyahu. So the assumption was they're going to probably do that again. But what's happened is Israel's completely broken the ceasefire. In fact, what Israel did is it applied a siege, it cut electricity, and it stopped aid going into the country when the ceasefire came to an end. And America actually hasn't done anything. So we're back to where we were before the ceasefire of Israel pounding Gaza. Israel's talking about creating more corridors. And what Israel's effectively doing is taking over Gaza. That's where we are. And not just in Gaza, we're seeing Israel expand in Syria under the guise of security. And in Lebanon, Israel never really withdrew. Israel still has around five bases. And now it's saying it doesn't actually plan to actually leave. And what's becoming more and more clear is the bigger plan really is to depopulate around Israel in the surrounding countries and then eventually annex them. So we're really back to where we were originally.
It seems like the genocide, it's actually causing major issues internally, not just in the US, but really the whole world. But one of the most famous cases in recent days was the possible deportation of Muhammad Khalil. What do you make of this, Adnan?
So yes, I feel this is very, very revealing of where America is at the moment. What's happened is Muhammad Khalil is a graduate from Columbia University, and Columbia University was where you had the big sit-ins, the pro-Palestinian sit-ins against the university, and their demand that you should divest from Israel. And what's happened is Muhammad Khalil actually wasn't a member of these. He actually was part of the intermediation between the activists and the university. And, you know, Israel, the American government all got involved, and they've been really making these protests actually much more violent than they really were. Or they've been given more airtime to the violent aspects than to the actual cause these demonstrations were trying to raise. So what's happened is a couple of weeks ago, Muhammad Khalil was coming home from a restaurant, and some normal clothed individuals surrounded him. So you'd think in any other place you're getting mugged or there's a fight. It turned out that these were immigration officers who said that your immigration status has been revoked, therefore we've come to arrest you to deport you. He then informed them that he's not an immigrant. He actually is a green card holder, which makes him a permanent resident, which is really interesting. These guys have come to arrest him and they don't even know the reason why they're arresting him. They actually got it wrong the first time around. So he's been disappeared now. He's gone through America's system. No one really knows where he is. But the more broader point here is, Muhammad Khalil, carries opinions which are different to the US position. He carries opinions that there's a genocide going on and Israel's carrying it out. And what's happened is America has lost the intellectual argument that they are now literally arresting and deporting people who have opinions that they don't like. And they've even admitted, the officers that arrested him and the state, that Muhammad Khalil has not committed any crime. So if he hasn't committed any crime, what on earth are you actually arresting him for? So many people have come out to defend Trump and the government. They say that the president has the right to revoke anyone's visa, revoke his green card. They're saying if he had put down his support for Hamas on his application, we would never have given to him. But he's never been a supporter of Hamas in the first place. What we are witnessing here is the US is literally having its USSR moment. This is exactly what the KGB used to do in the 70s and the 80s. If you had an opinion the state didn't like, it was an opinion against the state policy, you were disappeared. This is what America's come down to now. It has no ability to defend Israel now. Israel's committing a genocide. The genocidal evidence is growing. So how do you defend Israel? How do you defend your aircraft carrier in the Middle East? What you do now is you disappear those people and you deport them who hold opinions. I mean, this is very McCarthyite. This is where America is currently.
Where do you think this is going to go in the long term? Do you think America will actually change its position on Israel? Do you think that although Israel is vital for its interest, it becomes untenable to continue to support them?
So the American elite and even Israel, they've done a lot of lobbying in America that it's in American interest to support Israel. But Israel is losing credibility. People who are neutral can see through what they're doing. So we are getting to a point now where Israel is looking more and more like a liability. But America has invested 7 decades in Israel, it's built her up. It's not something it just wants to abandon. But by supporting it, it's like America's in an abusive relationship. You've got to get out of that relationship. You know, you can't really reform this. It's the nature of the beast. So, you know, America really is in the same position the USSR was in the 1980s. The USSR turned to Gorbachev, an outsider, in the hope he would reform and reverse the decline. America's have turned to Trump. Gorbachev got Russia out of the Afghan war. Trump got America out of the Afghan war. Trump is talking about nationalism and forget global empire. Gorbachev did the same thing, forget the Soviet Union, we've got to think about Russia. And in about 6 or 7 years, the Soviet Union collapsed. And that can happen in America as well. In fact, the divisions in America are very deep at the moment. So already the youth in America, the young, they have a very different view towards Israel. Their view is Israel is a liability. We need to drop it. The support for Israel is amongst the elder element of the US public. But everyone can see what Israel is doing. The problem America has is so intertwined with Israel that it can't see what's actually going on. And in fact, Israel is actually literally getting away with a genocide. So everything Israel is doing is making America look even worse because of its support.
What one thing that Israel has been doing is it's been interfering a lot in Syria. It now says it represents the Druze people, the Druze in Syria. And it's been continuing to expand in southern Syria. We've also seen some sectarian battles between the new regime and remnants of the old regime. Is Syria actually descending into chaos? Is it going to be another Libya?
So Syria has always been in chaos, and it's for one reason only, foreign interference. We see after World War II, there was chaos in Syria because the Americans backed a number of different coups. The Ba'athists came into power, supported by elements from outside the country, so that caused even more chaos. The Al-Assad family, they may have called him a reformer and a stabilizer, but for the people, it was complete chaos. So Syria has really been in the state because of foreign interference, not because of sectarianism, not because of these other factors. It's because this country is at the heart of the Middle East. Everybody wants a piece of it because it gives you influence within the region. So Israel senses the opportunity. In fact, Israel's most secure border was always Syria, despite its relationship with the Al-Assad family. And what Israel's doing now is senses we've got the opportunity to expand our territory, create a buffer zone. And that seems to be a common thing that's coming up. Let's take over territory, we'll call it a buffer zone under the guise of security. So what Israel's done is, firstly, on the day the regime fell, it carried out a airstrike campaign to take out Syria's heavy weapons. And it's taken over the Golan Heights now. It's actually saying now that the deal with the Golan Heights was with the Assad regime. They're gone now. So we've taken the whole thing over. And actually, they've been taking over even more territory in the south of Syria and saying that this is a buffer zone for us. So really, what Israel is expanding. I mean, Israel is a colonial settler project, and its expansion will never stop. That's the nature of a colony. You will always need to protect the heartland, and you do that by creating a huge buffer zone. So that's what Israel is doing. It's going to lead to tension. Already they're running into problems with Turkey. The regime at the moment is in such a weak position that under the Shara regime, there's nothing much they can really do. But Israel is very clear. Israel is expanding, and is expanding in Lebanon. Is trying to expand in Gaza. Is carrying out genocide in the West Bank. And in Lebanon, we're seeing it do action as well. So really, Israel senses that this is the opportunity of a lifetime. The regime in Syria is gone. There's nothing the new regime can do. So what they're trying to do is take over more and more territory, which eventually will annex and say it's part of Israel.
It's been 4 months since Bashar al-Assad was overthrown, something that didn't happen for 13 years. And then it took place in literally a week. What do we know now that we didn't actually know back then?
So the fall of the regime was quite sudden in the end. And you're right, 13 years, the regime survived, and all of a sudden in 1 week, it collapsed. And the difference really is we can't really divorce Syria from what's going on in the region. You've got Israel expanding, creating buffer zones, and Syria then got caught up in that. So what Israel's been doing is been targeting all the armed groups. And one of the biggest problems it has is the supply line for Hezbollah. It goes from Iran, Iraq, Syria into Lebanon. So Israel was able to win over America to this point of view. And what they did in the end, in order to cut the supply line, you needed Iran to leave the country. You needed Russia to leave the country. And really what they did was through Turkey supporting a number of groups in the north, they overthrew the regime. So really what's happened is Syria, the reason why we've seen change in Syria all of a sudden is because of what's been going on with Israel and America reshaping the security in the region. We do need to keep in mind that Bashar al-Assad and the Al-Assad family, for all the rhetoric and anti-imperialism, they had no problem defending Israel. The Israelis have always said their most secure border is the one with Syria. Bashar al-Assad helped America in the Iraq war. Really, he's been a proxy for America. What America's done is replaced one proxy with another guy, Ahmad al-Shara, who America's known since the early 2000s when he was in their prisons in Iraq. So it's not one leader's been overthrown, another one's come in. Really, both of these are under American influence and American know-how. So unfortunately, although everyone's very happy that the Bashar al-Assad regime is gone, you've actually replaced Bashar al-Assad, the Ba'athist secular leader, with a so-called Islamic leader who you've been nurturing, really. So yeah, in a nutshell, the reason why we had regime change in Syria was because Syria came into the equation of the Israeli-American agenda for the region. While for the last 13 years, it wasn't part of that. And in fact, the reason why the regime even survived this long is because America didn't make any effort to even overthrow the regime.
You mentioned the region. Are we going to see some more tension between Iran and the US?
So the only country calling for more war, the only country calling for a war with Iran is Israel. Israel's always had a problem with Iran. Israel has a problem with the armed groups, but he's dealt with them now. He's decimated Hezbollah. He's decimated Hamas. He's dealing with the Houthis. The Bashar al-Assad regime's gone, and rebel groups using Syria, that's completely gone as well. So the last remaining problem for Israel is actually Iran. And Israel has for a long time, for decades, tried to enlist America to launch strikes on Iran, to put back their nuclear program, to weaken it. In fact, in the 1990s, Netanyahu was able to win over the neocons to this idea. But then the neocons invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, and they got bogged down with that. So that plan was put to a side. So Israel is really pushing at the moment that it wants war, wants to put the nuclear program back. We're seeing already the B-2 bombers have been moved to Diego Garcia, which puts them in range of Iran. America continues to pound Yemen, which really is to show Iran, you know, if you don't negotiate, if you don't capitulate, you're going to basically get bombed. So I think we'll have to wait and see if it happens, but they're preparing the ground. What they want from Iran is complete capitulation. What we want you to do is give up your nuclear program, agree to new terms on how this program will be regulated and monitored by the West. And if Iran agrees to that, it is a capitulation, and Israel will just want more after that. It will just want more. So Iran really is in a position at the moment. What's your response? So what Iran is saying is, we don't want direct negotiations. We want indirect. You know, direct or indirect negotiations don't really make a difference. What's going on here is Israel and America are laying down the conditions. You either agree to them, if you don't. If you don't, get ready to get pounded. So really, the only option left for Iran is it needs to test a nuclear device and raise the cost of any strikes on Iran. But it's very likely, if Israel and America do launch strikes on Iran, they will put back its nuclear program. And this regime is now 40, 45 years old. It could get the Syrian treatment, where the clerics are removed, overthrown, and you get a new secular leader in this country. That is something Israel would love. And that may be the way to deal with Iran as well. So Iran has some serious strategic issues to contemplate. It doesn't look good at the moment. Iran is still talking about talking. It doesn't realize that the drumbeats of war have actually begun. So let's wait and see. But you know, the drumbeats of war are increasing. America's put its aircraft carriers in the region. It's got the B-2 bombers ready as well. So, you know, all of these are signs that there's potential strikes coming up. And if these strikes go ahead, it will really put Iran's program back significantly.
China's Huawei recently announced it was beginning trials of its domestically produced extreme ultraviolet machine. What does this mean from a geopolitical perspective?
So this is very big. These machines, these extreme ultraviolet machines, they're the size of a bus. And they are the nuclear weapons of our age. These are strategic, technologies where if you can make them yourselves, it means you can make the semiconductors that go into everything, the most advanced semiconductors. So we're talking jets and electronics and these sort of things. What America's been doing for the last few years from the Biden administration to Trump now, they've been putting sanctions, they've been putting barriers in the way of China getting this technology. And what Hawaii did is it tested its first ultraviolet machine. What this is it's a highly advanced laser machine that imprints on a wafer, which is what's used for semiconductors. So if China can do this on its own, because at the moment, there's only one company that produces these machines, it's ASML in Holland. And America has made sure that it doesn't sell these machines to China. And even the ones China does have, there's no servicing going on about them. If China can do this on its own, it completely changes the game. And you know, historically, whoever has the latest technology, whoever has the most advanced technology, is usually the power. So it is really looking like the power, the future is edging away from America and is moving more and more towards China. So this development is huge from a geopolitical perspective. So all the actions America did to stop this from happening have been a failure.
So off the back of that, and it ties in with one of the questions that we received, can China actually, do you see China being able to replace the US as a global superpower?
China has the potential to. You know, for a long time, China was a basket case. It was a communist nation. I mean, when it was communist, it was a disaster for the country, put back the country massively. But now China has sorted its economy out. China in 1979 had an economy smaller than Finland. I mean, Finland is probably the size of a city in China. Today, China is the second largest economy in the world. It's knocking on the doors of the number one economy. If you look at China's military, it's heading in the right direction. Although it's not a global military yet, it's going in that direction. On the tech side, China is innovating. The next generation of technology, China will surpass the West. It's already more advanced than the West when it comes to research. The challenge China really has is political. You know, China's not ideological. It's not trying to promote a way of life to the world. It's not trying to organize the world according to its values. It's not calling for democracy or these sort of things. What China's saying is the American control of the world, Western hegemony, is a problem. So what's your alternative? Well, their alternative is there just shouldn't be one hegemon. And the West should not expect the world to live according to their way of life. So China isn't calling for ideas or values that everybody should subscribe to. So if you were to ask the Chinese leadership, what world do you want to see? What they say is the world is dominated by one or two powers, which is bad, and that should be reshaped. That's it. And I think this is the fundamental problem. China's aim isn't to take over the world. And that's why China, it trades with the world. China exports to the rest of the world. It imports from a lot of the world as well. In terms of values, ideas, that's not the battle it's actually in. So when the West keeps saying that this battle between the West and China is between democracy and authoritarianism, well, who's the authoritarian? Because Trump's looking like the authoritarian at the moment. And China is the one advocating free trade, free markets. That's the scenario we're in. So definitely China has the potential. It's, you know, economically, it's in the right position. It's to be able to fund a advanced and growing military. On the tech side, it's getting there as well. Where it lacks is the political side. And if they can change that, then I think it changes the game completely. Even if they don't become ideological, America is doing so many actions of self-destruction. Power may move to China anyway. These tariffs America's doing, America keeps trampling over its values. America keeps looking more and more like the USSR. So power may go to China, even though it's not ideological anyway.
If we move to the Indian subcontinent, a few weeks ago, a Balochi outfit attacked a passenger train with 300 hostages in Pakistan. The army has been promoting its rescue operation and they've been blaming India for the incident. Now, we all know Balochistan, the province, has been quite troublesome for many years, for decades even. What's actually going on here?
So what happened is, I think just before Ramadan, you had this long-distance train that goes through Balochistan and a couple of the other provinces. So what happened was, is one of the armed groups in the region, they intercepted the train, they took everyone hostage, and then it took a number of hours for the army, for the intelligence services to finally put this to an end. Now, there's a broader issue here, which is Balochistan is Pakistan's largest province. It's its most richest province in terms of resources, but it's actually economically the most poorest region. The Balochi people have never been integrated into Pakistan. They feel Pakistan is dominated by Punjab, and the politicians only care about Balochistan when they want its resources or when they want to test nuclear weapons. So as a result, over time, movements have emerged, protests have emerged, and the way successive Pakistan administrations dealt with this was with the very heavy hand of the army. They went in and carried out operations, which led to massacre of people. On other occasions, we see the intelligence services disappear people and people turn up dead. They take out some of their leaders. The problem with this instability is it allowed other countries to get involved in this region. So Balochistan in Pakistan, it shares a border with Afghanistan and Iran. So when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, they used their intelligence to get support of some of the Balochi groups against Pakistan, because Pakistan was supporting the Afghan people against the Soviet invasion. When Iran and Iraq went to war, Iraq reached out to some of these groups in order to get their support against Iran. And what we find is even India has actually supported and armed some of these groups, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So you've had a number of different groups who come together sometimes. Sometimes they fight separately. So you've got the BLA, Balochistan Liberation Army. You've got the Balochi Liberation Front. And, you know, really, there's more deeper issues there where the central government of Pakistan actually failed these people. And that's why many resort to these actions in order to get independence. Balochi supporters are very active in Europe, in America. They want independence. They want separation from Pakistan. And really, unfortunately, this is another case of where, you know, in the Muslim world, this is quite common, where an element of the population is neglected or they're oppressed, and then they respond with armed actions, and then you have an even bigger clampdown by the regime and the armed forces, which makes the problem even worse. The bigger problem here is foreign intelligence agencies are taking advantage of this as well. So what you find is Pakistan was openly blaming India. The Indian media really went to town on this attack to show the insecurity in Pakistan. Pakistan was just blaming India all along, which got the Indian media going, who started attacking Pakistan as well. So although it's been nearly a month and a half, 2 months now, the underlying problem is still there. They've not really been resolved, and they will likely continue, unfortunately.
Our final question, the long-term dictator of Bangladesh, Hasina, was overthrown. It's been 8 months now. What's the situation currently on the ground?
Wow, so 8 months. Time flies. So there's been quite a few developments in Bangladesh. Obviously, Hasina was overthrown. And what you had was a hodgepodge of people emerge as a transitional government. In the end, Muhammad Yunus became the leader of this government, a darling of the West, a darling of the World Economic Forum. I mean, you probably couldn't find anyone more aligned to the West than Muhammad Yunus. So he became the face of this government, and they faced quite a few challenges. Firstly, India was very unhappy with the development. Sheikh Hasina had a very deep security relationship because of her father with India. So they were really unhappy with what happened. In fact, they felt they've lost the influence in Bangladesh. So obviously, this new government's coming. It's a transitional government. They keep delaying the elections that are supposed to happen at some point. What they've been doing is a couple of things. Firstly, they don't really want elections until certain reforms have been made. So Sheikh Hasina had gutted the state. She had gutted the legal system. And what they want to do is make constitutional and legal changes before there's an election, because the system was used by Hasina against her own people. So that's one thing that's actually going on. The other thing is, you know, a lot of the economy was a big problem for a lot of people. It didn't serve them. In fact, these protests originally that turned into her overthrow were from students. So what you find is the economic side is actually getting worse. So recently, Muhammad Yunus has tried to make a deal with China, which has really upset India. So there's a lot of long-term things that still haven't actually been dealt with. There's been a big push by India to promote the uprising and the new government as Islamist. This is an Islamist takeover, and that's the narrative they've been trying to give. In fact, they've been maligning the protest movements that actually happened. The BNP, the Bangladesh National Party, seem to be making some sort of comeback. They're probably going to play quite a key role. The army has been engaging them. The government has been engaging them. They don't want elections until these constitutional changes and reforms have been made. Because the legal system and the constitution and the state was used by, for the advantage of the Awami Party and Sheikh Hasina. So they want this all adjusted before they have elections and they take over the state. So things are definitely still in a flux in Bangladesh, definitely settlements going on. What I can see is the traditional government seems to consist of very different. This is not a normal political party. It's not a normal government. What's happened is very quickly certain people come together, human rights background, Western background. Muhammad Yunus wasn't even in the country. And what's happened is these people have got different views on the direction the country should go. And that hasn't helped. So yeah, let's wait and see. 8 months isn't a long time. But yeah, definitely the uprising, things are still in transition really, still in the flux at the moment.
Perfect. Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com, all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.